Everyone enjoys a good time, and a good time online is even better. At KingTractorPress.com, fans of comic books, webcomics, and graphic novels have been having a blast since 2006. The home of new webcomics like sci-fi thriller Gene Gardens and the humor-laden Daddy's Girls, KingTractorPress.com offers online fun for distinguished audiences. And when you visit KingTractorPress.com, be sure to check out King Tractor's Five and Dime, where you can get buttons, pens, toys, and lots of other cool stuff. Visit KingTractorPress.com today.
You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast at newscast.webcomicbeacon.com.
Welcome to the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. It's Sunday, July 22nd. I'm your host today, Marie Terry of EvilSpaceCat.com. And joining us today are two new voices, Dean Esme from DeanEsme.com.
Hi there.
And Chelsea Beckard from Misty.EvilSpaceCat.com.
Sup?
And now the news. Our top story today is the digital comics price fight that has come out of San Diego Comic-Con. There was a panel, actually, on it, and it's apparently a really, really hot topic among comic makers, and it was discussed recently during a panel at the San Diego Comic-Con of the move towards digital comics and digital media and the price and costs associated with that. In the particular panel that was being discussed, there was a number of well-known commentators and panel members. So Mark Waid of Thrillbent was there, Scott Kurtz of PvP, Jeff Weber of IDW Publishing, and Chris Ross of Top Shelf came together to discuss this topic in a panel that was moderated by Comixology's Chip Mosher. When asked what the ideal price for digital comics was, there was quite a differing of opinions among the panelists. Mark Waid suggested the 99-cent price mark, while Jeff Weber suggested a staggered price model from full cover to discounting over time. Scott Kurtz felt that depending on the use of the digital market, that should influence the price, while Chris Ross took a specific look at what sort of comics should be priced in what way, suggesting that for at least his company that published typically large graphic novels, that it wouldn't be appropriate to price them at 99 cents, and that digital strategy should encourage physical ownership. The discussion then moved to how the 99-cent price point was about the discovery of comics and making them more accessible. And an example of Angry Birds was held up, which provides, of course, many, many hours of frustrating entertainment for 99 cents, as opposed to a comic or graphic novel, which you might blow through in a couple of hours for, like, $4. Both Mark Waid and Scott Kurtz expressed how lower free pricing gets new readers and makes books more accessible, as opposed to Jeff and Chris's feelings that full cover or supplemental pricings need to be there to protect physical sales. Apparently, there's still quite a divide on this issue. So, if you're interested for more, it's from our source at comicsbeat.com, and there is a nice link in the show notes. So now we're going to go over to our buzz with Dean.
Hi there. Oni Press has announced a set of new webcomics print editions that they're going to be issuing. According to the industry trade publication ICV2, on July 13th, Oni Press announced that it will begin print collection of Double Fine Action Comics by Scott C. and Diesel Sweeties by R. Stevens, starting spring next year. Oni is going to launch its first printed collection of Double Fine Action Comics in chronological order next April, first reprinting the debut volume of the long-running series, along with a second volume of never-before-undead tree material at the same time, and then a third volume that collects the rest of the strip's run set for the third quarter of 2013. Diesel Sweeties, which has thousands of installments that have been published on the web over the last decade-plus, will, on the other hand, not be published in chronological order, but rather organized by common themes. It's unclear at this time if they intend to make the complete run of the series available in this fashion or only select portions. Over at Boing Boing, Jamie Frivell, noted on Monday, July 16th, that even though very little appears to be forthcoming from DC Comics in film after next year's Man of Steel movie, Marvel Studios has chosen to double down on its investment in its superhero movies. In a plan they're openly referring to as, in capital letters, Phase 2, Marvel execs have made it clear that you can pretty much expect sequels to every single property they've released so far, including things like Iron Man 3, Captain America 2, and Thor 2. To some eyes, it appears that Marvel Studios intends to pretty closely match the way it does its comic books, keep issuing new episodes as long as the public will keep buying. In addition to sequels to all its current movies, Marvel is also planning a release of the 2008 Guardians of the Galaxy series, preliminarily slated for release late to 2014. So while sequels are definitely in the works, new stuff we haven't seen from the Marvel Studios before is coming down the pike, too. One link you won't want to miss in a new story, one link you won't want to miss this week, is a brief interview with Randall Monroe, author of one of technology nerddom's favorite comics, XKCD. He answers hypothetical questions of physics posed by Alan Gardner, such as, what would happen if you tried to hit a baseball thrown at 90% of the speed of light? The basic answer, you and everyone behind you will likely be destroyed. Or what are the odds of getting a perfect score on the SAT by just random guessing? Turns out awfully low. And how much force power can Yoda exert? Apparently at least 18.3 kilowatts. Not surprising, Randall's answers are quite a bit more detailed than that and well-reasoned. So be sure to check that link below the podcast here. And, of course, check out XKCD itself every chance you get. And finally on the buzz, there's the elephant-in-the-room story that almost no one really wants to talk about at all, but has to be, the Batman shooting. 12 people were killed and 38 wounded by a crazed lunatic at the midnight showing of The Dark Knight Rises in Colorado. It's almost impossible to imagine you haven't already heard about this before now, but what we'd like to draw your attention to is a post by Matt Welch of Reason Magazine entitled, Half-Assed Media Speculation About the Batman Shooter. Blogging real-time, Welch showed story after story of irresponsible people making wild speculation about what had happened, who had done it, and what their motives were. A Colorado man was named as a possible suspect just because he happened to have the same name as the shooter, and his name appeared on a Denver area political website. It turned out not to be that same guy at all, and both he and his employer had to issue public statements about it. There were politicians ranting about religious values. A university professor was quoted trying to clinically diagnose the shooter as if he had ever even met this person, which he hadn't. Efforts were made to tie the shooter to another political group, while still others were busy blaming, you guessed it, violent video games. And all this before we even had more than a smattering of details. It is difficult not to laugh a little morbidly at this, but one news expert, quote-unquote expert, a former FBI agent no less, was actually quoted saying that it might have been, and I quote, some dark, Trekkie-like person, unquote. Because, as we all well know, the most dangerous of all the world's geeks, even worse than video game players, are those pernicious Trekkies. Whatever we find out, let it be found out as authorities do their investigation. More important, give families time to process their trauma and grief. Our heartfelt prayers and sympathies to everyone who was affected by this horrible crime. And that's the buzz for this week. Please be sure to click the links below the podcast to see all this material for yourself. Back to you, Maureen.
Thank you, Dean. Now we're on to the business section, and we've got three stories in business today. The first story of which is that apparently Ron Peraza has left Comixology. It's not entirely clear as to why he's left yet, but apparently it was mutual and amicable, so you can read into that whatever you want. If you're interested in more information regarding this as it develops, check out our source, bleedingcool.com, and the link is in the show notes, and I'm sure there will be more as this comes along. Our second story is that things are apparently looking better in the comic market. Coming to us from blog.comichron.com is a story that is pointing that sales of comics is actually starting to recover and gain some ground, especially in comparison to other magazines. Some of the facts that they point to that the comic market is improving is that digital sales are increasing, but so are the print sales. Both of them are actually actually growing together. It doesn't appear that one or the other is winning out, at least so far. The digital market digital trade paperback market was $25 million and print stood at, or sorry, digital trade for last year was $25 million. Print stood at $680 million. And apparently it's doubled every year since about 2009. So we're looking at perhaps double digits, and that's going to be very exciting for a lot of people, I'm sure. And also, between the direct market, the bookstores, digital comics, has become apparently the healthiest part of the magazine business because people keep comics, people collect comics, people pre-buy comics. So this is apparently quite something in the declining print market for magazines to see comics so strong. It's quite a long article. You probably want to check it out in more detail, especially if you are interested in what's going on in the comic market, and the link is in the show notes. Our final story in business, coming to us from ICV2.com, is that Diamond, the famous singular distributor for comics, is offering a bunch of new retailers' expansion incentives. And are trying to expand. They're cooperating with a bunch of other market suppliers, obviously. So like Marvel, Dark Horse, DC, Diamond Select Toys, Dynamite Entertainment, IDW Publishing, Image Comics, and Marvel have all basically signed on to provide qualifying retailers with incentives. Some of the incentives include free goods, extra discounts, consignment backlist programs, and to also open a new location or move to better locations. So if you're interested in this, it's quite lengthy and it's got a lot of details in it. Do check out the link in the show notes and check it out, because it's very interesting that they are offering, so much free product now of two retailers to try to help them out, it looks like. So that's all that there is in business. And now we're going to head over to tech, our tech department, with Chelsea. What do we got in tech today?
Well, for the first story in tech comes from GigaOhm.com, and Twitter has announced that they're filing an appeal in a case that is hoping to help define privacy rights in the social media era. New York has filed a subpoena that wants Twitter to turn over account information for the Occupy Wall Street protester named Malcolm Harris. And in a controversial decision in October, the judge, Matthew Cirino Jr., has ruled that Harris couldn't challenge the subpoena because he didn't have any rights in the Twitter account and therefore lacked any standing. And once Harris was booted from the court, Twitter actually stepped up itself and tweeted that they're trying to appeal the Harris decision. And Twitter has responded with, well, a tweet that they are appealing the Harris decision, and it doesn't strike the right balance between the rights of users and the interests of law enforcement. If you would like to read more about it, please do check the link in the show notes. Our next story in tech is YouTube seems to be wanting to up the quality of their videos. So, by doing this, they are going to be starting with a sort of summer school. They're going to be hosting weekly hangouts over the Google Hangout application, and they're 9 people at a time are going to be able to join these hangouts. An unlimited number of people can watch via Google Plus, and archived recordings of the hangouts are going to be available on YouTube as well. So if you're interested in that, check out the links on GigaOhm.com via the show notes. And yeah, that's it for tech.
All right, thanks, Chi. Now we're going to go over to our education with Dean.
Hi there. Over at geek-news.mtv.com, the MTV geek Sean Kleefeld, writing his Kleefeld on Comics column, has an interesting historical recollection this week, as well as speculation about the future entitled it WitherCon. Comic book conventions appear to have really first started in people's individual houses back in the 1960s, according to Kleefeld, and then the first formal public convention was held in Detroit in the mid-1960s, about 1964, according to him. These events were largely held for people who collected paper and ink comic books, as you might imagine, which at the time were completely dominated by superhero comic books and a few other action genre, westerns, that sort of thing, as they still are to a large extent today, which leads Kleefeld and others to an interesting question, not whether is there anything wrong with superhero comics per se, but do webcomic artists fit in with that crowd? Some webcomic creators have gone to such conventions and found themselves frustrated because they have little or no wares to sell to the people of those conventions, and some even feel out of place because their webcomic material has nothing to do with the genres of fiction that are most popular with the, quote, comic book convention crowd, unquote. At least one webcomics artist is reported as saying she just does much better at anime conventions than the traditional comic book conventions because the audience there is generally more interested in things outside of superhero comics, which raises the interesting question, which we cannot answer here, as to whether webcomics creators and fans really feel that the big comic cons have anything to offer them. Some do, some don't, and I guess the real question would be, what do you think? Maybe we'll talk about it more later. Back to you, Marie.
All right. Thank you, Dean. We're going to go ahead and take our first break, so we'll be right back after this.
Once again, this episode is brought to you by King Tractor Press at kingtractorpress.com, home of Family Bones and the webcomic Gene Gardens. That's kingtractorpress.com.
And we're back from break. We're starting in back again with our tidbit section with Chelsea. Chelsea?
Thank you. So first in tidbits, this has got a follow-up story from last week about, is Kickstarter the number two graphic novel publisher? Coming from Tor.com, Stephen Padnick says, and I quote, no, it is not. And he goes on to discuss on how Kickstarter isn't a publisher at all. It is just a means of getting funds, and Kickstarter gives creators the money they need before actually selling their product. He also states that saying Kickstarter is the number two publisher is basically saying that banks or day jobs are also the number two comic publisher. For more, please check out the link in the show notes. Our second story in tidbits is Penny Arcade is thinking about starting up a America's Next Top webcomic sort of show. Essentially, they're going to be inviting webcomic artists to send samples of their work in a quick video of themselves stating why they would like to be on the show. And then they take all these submissions, narrow it down to about a cast of 10 people, and flown out to Seattle to live in a house rigged with cameras. And they will be put through a set of challenges based on the skills they need to run a successful webcomic. And at the end of the day, the last artist standing will win a sizable cash prize along with getting plugged into the Penny Arcade machine for 1 year. And that's it for tidbits. Back to you, Marie.
All right, thank you, Chelsea. We're going to go on to our oddity section with Dean. Dean?
In our oddities section this week, we have three interesting stories. Over at Slacktree.com, Nick Douglas reports on a Shell Oil parody and Shell Oil itself's own response to same. Apparently a group called the Yes Men and Greenpeace, at least according to Nick Douglas at Slacktree, set up a series of phony viral ads for Shell Oil trying to promote their efforts to do safe drilling for oil up there in the Arctic. And they look pretty authentic. If you follow on Twitter at Arctic Ready, that's at ArcticReady, it looks like Shell Oil. They got the Shell logo on there and a bunch of parody ads that make Shell look pretty silly. What's an ironic twist is, it's up to you whether you think this is good or bad for Shell, is that Shell managed to demonstrate that they have no idea what they're doing with social media and Twitter in specific, and probably ought to hire somebody who actually has been on Twitter for a while and using it, because they posted a series of obviously not very thought out responses like, please stop retweeting these, and please, well, to be honest, it almost feels like, please stop making fun of us, please stop, we're going to sue, don't do this, someone seems to have invaded our servers and we're investigating now, blah blah blah, making it just very clear that Shell had no idea what was going on or how to give a professional response to somebody making parodies of you. You can read about that in the Slacktree.com link below or follow at Arctic Ready, and also at Shell Is Prepared, which was Shell's official responses. In another story, this is one of those cute ones that make you go, aw. ComicsAlliance.com reports an interesting story you can find down below about how the Make-A-Wish Foundation put together a really rather elaborate wish for a kid, a disabled kid who's had all kinds of medical issues. He wanted to be a superhero, or he wanted to be a hero that could chase down a supervillain. So they got a guy named Rex Velvet with an eye patch and a mustache, and had the kid, who called himself Special Agent C, running all over the Seattle area, even using things like helicopters and all that stuff to track down the supervillain Rex Velvet. And Agent C eventually catches him, and the world is saved from supervillain Rex Velvet. Kind of cute. You might want to go check that link out. And finally, in the also weird section, the Associated Press reports that a professor wearing a set of computerized specs, really similar to the Google specs that you may have heard about, was in a McDonald's, and McDonald's employees reached out and pretty much assaulted the guy and grabbed him off his face and such, because they feared that their privacy was being invaded and he was recording them, and they didn't want to be recorded and they didn't have a right to be recorded, raising all kinds of interesting questions of, well, do you have a right to record people if you're walking around? I could do that with a video camera. Why not the specs, etc.? Anyway, you can read about the controversy there and wonder if Google's going to have some problems when they release their own specs to the real world. And with that, back to you, Marie. Done with the oddities section.
All right. We're moving on to the things that make us cry. And there's two stories in that today. And the first story is about Rush Limbaugh, who tries to link the Dark Knight Rises character Bane and Bain, that is the venture capital company co-founded by Mitt Romney, in a political debate, which is kind of sad. The story is coming to us from comicbookresources.com, and if you start to read into it, he is essentially trying to connect the character of Bane to this other company, but what he seems to fail to realize is that this character, the character Bane, was created two decades ago by Chuck Dixon, who is probably, actually has political views that are closer in line with Romney's than Obama's, and it is also debuted a year before Romney launched his unsuccessful 1994 bid to unseat said Ted Kennedy. So it's kind of ludicrous, really, all told. You can go ahead and read it and be as dumbfounded as I was over at comicbookresources.com. The link is in the show notes. And our second story in the things that make us cry is that apparently Batwoman needs to start purging. If you're confused as to what this means, this was found by a number of sources, and it's one I've been personally following. It's on onezoomiverse.com and eshergirls.tumblr.com, and it was also on silkysuin.deviantart.com. All links will be in the show notes. But basically, this all started with a young comic book hopeful, Silkysuin, I think is how you pronounce her name, I'm not sure. But she went to San Diego Comic-Con and brought her portfolio, as so many other artists do, and tried to get some industry comic book professionals to give her some feedback. And she had a rather, actually, very nice black-and-white picture of Batwoman. And she was told that about this particular picture, that her breasts were too small, they didn't have enough lift, that her jawline was fat, her neckline was too long, her hair was too clunky, her hips, waist, and thighs were too big, and she looked fat. And that apparently that nobody was going to want to read a comic with a fat female protagonist, and that she should look at Sports Illustrated models to get the anatomy right. And they're the peak of human perfection. I'm not going to say anything because it's probably worth to go into the discussion portion, but I think that we can all kind of raise an eyebrow at this criticism. Now, Onizumi goes on to talk about sort of what is the challenges in the industry are, and that there is no real champion right now that really cares about going after the female demographic with superhero comics in specific, and has the political clout not to have that message really destroyed, and that there's a lot of doubt as to whether this is going to change much until all the current powers that be are retired, and some new blood comes in there. But if you want to read more about it, I suggest checking out the link notes. And we're going to be going to take our second break now, and then we're going to move on to our discussion section. So we'll be right back after this.
This program is a part of the Webcast Beacon Network and is hosted on the Rampage Network. Follow us on Twitter for news links as we find them at Webcomic Z. Email us at webcomicbeaconnews@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 1-320-310-0922. Love the show? Please grab the iTunes or RSS feed. We're also on Stitcher.com with Stitcher Smart Radio, an on-demand service where you can stitch podcast and radio show feeds together for your own personal streaming service. The Webcast Beacon Network, covering and promoting creativity in the creative process since 2007. Webcomics, comic books, news, and web fiction at webcastbeacon.com. Now, back to our show.
And we're back, and now we're on to our discussion section. So with your host today, of course, me, Marie Terry from EvilSpaceCat.com, and my fellow discussion panelists from DeanEsme.com, Dean Esme.
Hello.
And from Misty.EvilSpaceCat.com, Chelsea Beckard.
Yo, what's up?
All right, so we got a couple of stories here we want to discuss. So the first one on our list is the controversy over digital comic prices that came from Comic-Con, but I thought it would be interesting for us to discuss it. Personally, this is something I've been fighting with a bit because, of course, I do two comics, web comics. I do Brimstone and Shifters. And I've been wrestling with doing PDF issues and trying to figure out where to price them. I know that, you know, as far as a consumer is, you know, the 99-cent price point is attractive if you're buying from iTunes, but what if you're buying from other places? Does it matter as much? Then there's also things like premium content from blogs and being a blogger. Dean, I would imagine you have some opinions on that.
Novelist, too.
Oh, a novelist, too. Okay, well, there you go. So, and there, some ideas of that, and I'm sure, you know, Chelsea is an artist, so she probably has some idea on art collections or art portfolios. What
well,
you
I have bought a few comics.
Yeah, I bought a few comics. So what do you all think?
Well, what I think is, I don't know. the truth is, you know, I have my own novel that I co-authored called Methuselah's Daughter. We've had it available in ebook format for a year or two. And we have jiggered around with prices on that thing more than once. I think we were at $5 as a standing price for a while there, $4.99, you know, how that little game goes. We had a special sale for 99 cents. Saw a little bit of a bump, not much. We actually even had a – and so even though it's not comics, I would think it's kind of similar. There's something very attractive about 99 cents because people will just say, well, hell, I'll give you a dollar. But at the same time, does that give you enough money as a creator? And
I'm guessing they're going for the bubblegum theory. The idea that, you know, people at 99 cents, a lot of people at 99 cents will buy as opposed to pay, you know, less people who would pay $5 to, well, as I think it was Scott Kurtz who put it, that it was renting a comic on your Kindle or on your iPad or whatever because, you know, it's on your digital, it's not a real physical print thing that you can trade to your friends or whatever, you know, technically, unless you're doing it legally. You know, and on things like iTunes, it's fairly common. Although I've seen more and more stuff on iTunes going beyond the 99 cent mark, like apps and things being like $1.99 or $2.99. So I don't know if that's as true as it was maybe years ago when we were getting people to just buy into digital media.
I suspect that this is a debate that's going to keep going for a few years. Nobody seems to have settled on a model that works for them.
Yeah.
It seems really that there's two sides to the equation. There seems to be that there is the publisher side who want supplemental pricing for books to supplement the printed versions, and then there's the consumer side which says make it cheap and easy to access, like either make it free or make it cheap, like 99 cents or whatever, less than that.
What I found with people that have comics and when they publish them in PDFs and paper, that for one, never price them exactly the same because you can charge people more for an actual book because you're actually getting something to hold in your hands, but just a file that can be copied and it's not limited in a way that, like, you have to at least half the price of the book.
Well, yeah, I definitely think there should be a difference, and I think that there, you know, what that difference is exactly is what's the debate in terms of, like, what, in fact, that should be. Like, I mean, if you're publishing graphic novels, like, there was the one fellow, I think it was from Top Shelf, who was saying that their comics are big graphic novel type comics, and they're not going to be, you know, it's not really viable for them to give away a graphic novel in 99 cents.
I could honestly buy a graphic novel, like, on PDF for, like, $15 easily. I mean, I buy, like, 30-something page comics for 10.
Well, you know what that gets back to is, can you convince the general public that comics deserve the kind of respect that a novel, a book, does? There does seem to be this public perception that comics are, I mean, it's changing, but still, like, it's a comic book. I'm going to blow through that in 5 minutes. Never mind that the artists, you know, is getting carpal tunnel syndrome, working 8 hours to lay out one page of this damn thing. The public doesn't see it that way, and so why would I pay $10 for something I'm going to blow through in 20 minutes?
Well, I think that's part of the big debate.
Right.
All right. I think that we probably don't want to spend too much time talking about that one. So let's move on to the next story that we were going to talk about, which is the Penny Arcade webcomic reality show. What do you guys think about this?
Dumbest thing I've ever heard.
You want it
really? Dude, have you guys watched, like, they compared it to being a Hell's Kitchen for web cartoonists, and I think that would be the best thing in the world, honestly.
Well, you know what? I'm not a web cartoonist, so I can't say. You guys are, and it sounds incredibly dumb to me. I mean, challenges, really? Write two, you know, three pages now. Go on Superman. Go. What?
I have issues with reality shows in general, but I mean, there are a couple that I do admittedly have a guilty pleasure with that are artistic related. One is, which is Face Off, which is makeup artists.
Oh yeah, that one.
Doing challenges and things, and there are actually a number of these sorts of things that happen as part of the culture, as far as like art jams and art challenges are concerned with artists. It's like, you know, you have a theme. You have, you know, an hour to draw a 3-page comic about this theme. Go. And you all you guys do that together. And it's like, and everybody compares notes at the end and is like, oh, see what everybody came up with. And it's very inspiring. And it's kind of like flexing your art muscles. But I don't know about the idea of it as a reality show. I'm not sure how exciting that is. I mean, it's exciting when you're doing it, but I don't know about watching it.
And aren't really some of the best webcomics the ones where the creator has spent maybe years developing their idea
they spent years and years doing an idea and then they reboot it or they start something completely new. Like they drop whatever they were doing and then they decide to apply it to something completely new.
It's a neat idea, and the way Penny Arcade is doing it, I mean, you're getting somebody that probably might not have had the chance to like ever break out into the industry, getting, like, basically attached to the Penny Arcade name for a year, and that's quite a big name.
Well, you know what? Color Dean is skeptic, and she and mine went blank, Marie. I was thinking it sounds cool, huh? I guess.
I guess people would probably watch it. I mean, there has been times when I've drawn in public and people just sit there and watch me, but you know, I just kind of wonder how it would work and how it would ultimately play out. I mean, one of the things, too, about being a successful webcomic is stamina. You have to have the stamina to, like, they would definitely get a kickstart, for sure. I mean, you know, in terms of, like, getting the, I don't know if I should use the word kickstart, but they would get kind of a launch, obviously, with all of our Penny Arcade's popularity and essentially media machine behind them. But a lot of, you know, you can get a really good, like, you know, zoom forward if you don't have the stamina to keep going after the fact. Then you're just going to flounder and fall after, like, about a year. I mean, most webcomics don't last that long.
The main part I'm interested in, though, is just, it's going to be 10 artists in a house, and cameras are going to be on them. You go to a con, and it's already hilarious just to watch artists interact with each other, be it both all of them are shy, and you don't hear anything, and they're just in a room awkward, or, you know, they're battling over which pencil is the right kind of pencil, or...
I'm not your bitch, bitch. I'm not using that number to... whatever. I'm not buying it.
The reason why anybody watches reality shows, it's for the drama, and with artists, there's a lot of it.
I have to admit, there is a lot of drama often between
artists. It would be beautiful.
I don't know about that, but, you know, if you're into drama, it could very well work. Okay, well, let's move on from that then to our kind of really juicy discussion topic, which is, of course, about the Batman artwork that was deemed to be fat. And apparently Batwoman needs to start, needs to start purging. So
Batman's getting pretty hefty these days.
And he's like, arrrr, you know. It's like, it's a beefcake. But Batwoman, specifically, apparently is in this one artwork that was shown, if you've
beautiful.
Been to the show notes and you've seen the image, it was, actually, I personally think it's a lovely image. I think it's really beautiful.
I can understand. I mean, this picture doesn't nearly have big enough boobs to fit in with DC. The triple D's.
I have two.
You know, to be flopping and be in what's the word? Hassle.
Bulbous.
Yes.
I have two completely different opinions on this that are completely and totally contradictory. I don't know how old you guys are. I'm probably the old part in the room. I've been reading comics since the 70s.
You might be. I don't want to say exactly how old I am, but I was.
I've been reading.
Yeah, if you're reading by the 70s, then you're probably slightly older than me, but...
Yeah. And I've actually watched how this debate began in the 70s. And so from my perspective, when I hear something about how, well, we're going to have to wait for a new generation to come along, I'm like, I think I started reading about this in the late 70s, and I start looking at my watch. The comic book, I've seen the comic book executives say, girls won't read comics. We try. Every time when we try, they don't buy. We don't care. Boys want this. They don't want to just say, boys want big tits and nice asses. But it's what they mean. And they keep claiming that when they try, it doesn't work out. Although, I don't know, don't remember too many big busted babes in Neil Gaiman stuff. But, you know, at the same time, I would ask you two ladies to tell me, do you somehow have body image issues or feel repelled from drawing comics because you see busty bimbos that 15-year-old boys like looking at? I mean...
It influences what I read in the sense that I find it's like, well, you know, it's comics. I've grown up with the comics always having these characters. I don't necessarily have image issues from the comics, but there are times when I look at them and I do go... oh my God, that artwork is so broken. Like, you know, like, oh my God. Like, there are times when I have actually been turned off of comics by the artwork being so horrible anatomically and just unrealistic that I've been like, you know what, I'm not going to buy this particular line because, like, this artist just doesn't know what they're doing as far as anatomy is concerned. It's like, it's pretty clear that they're pandering to the male crowd, and it's done in a really horrible way. Okay, if you're going to get somebody to draw, you know, a real Barbie doll-esque figure, at least get somebody who knows how to draw. I mean,
my stance on the thing is, comic artists, from a woman, boobs don't work that way.
No, they don't. Do they?
As a proud owner of two boobs, they don't work that way.
And as a proud owner of two very large boobs, they don't look like that unless they're packed full of silicone. They just don't. Gravity works.
But let me give you the kind of the masculinist perspective on this. How many guys do you know are built like Batman?
Surprisingly, I don't know why, but there are a whole bunch of really, really athletic African-American fellows at the college where I work, and oh my God, they do look like Batman. They really, really do. But they're in the gym like all day, for every day, forever. Most of the guys actually hang out with, I mean, these guys are the guys I go and drool over, but, you know, like most of the guys I know in real life, and even the man I love, and I spent like most of my adult life with, is not like that at all. But, at the same time, it's like, you know, it's, I don't really want to aspire to be a Barbie doll.
But still, yeah. Like, you've got to think that people, like, Batman is doing a lot of shit. He's running around on his, he's running around beating people up. He's going to have a killer bod. But, see, the thing is, with people like Catwoman or Batwoman, they're probably not going to have, like, curves. They're going to have muscles. They're probably going to have smaller boobs.
If you look at what a really athletic female looks like, if you look at athletic, like Olympic athletes are a really good example in particular sports, is like they have different body types depending on the sport that they do. And it is actually a hindrance to have large breasts to perform a lot of the maneuvers that, like, you know, a lot of these athletic females are doing. It would be more advantageous and probably more likely that they would have a low body fat percentage. And unless they were full of silicone, they probably actually wouldn't have much in the way of breasts.
Yeah, actually,
have you ever seen, like, a lady bodybuilder?
Sorry, what were you saying, Dean?
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt. But I was just going to say, if you actually just study a little biology, you know that women who work out super heavy and get very muscular, their boobs actually do tend to shrink.
They're fat.
Yeah, thank you.
They are sacks of fat.
Pretty much. We like we love your sacks of fat, by the way, ladies. But
yeah, but you look at Olympic level or even high level gymnasts. They're not particularly busty.
Nope.
And you know, and even too, like I think they miss this. There is a sexy quality about a girl with curves. I don't think that any, you know, like a girl with hips, real hips and a bum and, you know, could be, you know, somewhat athletic, probably wouldn't be as athletic as her live counterpart, but, you know, would, you know, there's nothing that isn't sexy about that. I mean, you look at the old Cheesecake pinups from like the 50s and stuff, and it's like they weren't that skinny. Even Marilyn Monroe herself was not that skinny.
She was like
not at all
50.
Maybe.
She was chunky, and it was beautiful.
There's an interesting book I would recommend to both of you and to the readers. It was published by Kitchen Sink back in 1997. It's called The Great Women Superheroes by Trina Robbins. Now, I didn't agree with all of her political stances in that, but whatever. It's a pretty extensive history of women in comic book art going all the way back to, like, even the 20s and 30s. And it's striking the way women were drawn in action stuff back then as opposed to how they're drawn now. And actually, that was the first thing that struck me when I looked at that Batwoman thing. It's like, it looks like she's really striking back to a 1950s style. Now, I dig the hell out of that style. I really do. But I'm 47 years old.
But you know what? I dig it too. This is the thing. I'm a decade younger, and I still dig that style. I actually love the retro-ish feel of it and the difference in the body image. It is a more realistic body image, and I don't find it unflattering. Oh, I think she looks healthy, to be honest.
I think she looks hot.
Yeah, and it feels very kind of Art Nouveau in a way, and I really like it. Like, I really think it's a great difference. Like, it's something different. Like, I think that's another thing. It's like, sometimes when you get something that's a little different or, you know, maybe a little retro, it's like you can attract a whole new group of people because it's something very different that is yet familiar. You know, like, it's new and interesting in a retro kind of way, but I don't see anything wrong with this drawing. I really, really don't. I mean, they might think that's what we... I think a lot of the times when you get these people going, is, oh, we're not selling to girls or whatever, it's like, I think, too, it's like, you've been used to pandering to guys for so long, you know, you don't really realize that, you know, what chicks want and what we want in terms of... And they've done surveys and they've done marketing things and everything else, and, I mean, I think, you know, it kind of comes down to just... you know, treat women like people and, you know, be a little bit more realistic about it and don't pander so much to the boys. Try to just, you know, write a good story.
It's can't have hot women, though.
Oh, no. There's nothing
wrong. Ladies like the hot ladies.
Well, you know what? And I'll stick up a little bit for the 14-year-old boys who need the ridiculous-looking stuff. I think most of them are smart enough to know girls don't really look like that. And if that were a niche, you know, the unrealistic, anti-gravity boobs and the wasp waist and the super long legs, if that was one set of style, who would care?
Well,
you know,
either
like anime or you don't, right? Same kind of principle. But it's like the print market is stuck on this mold, and they don't want to leave it. I think it's going to be a webcomics people like you who are going to have to go in new directions.
Well, I have gotten comments before, like, speaking as one of my characters does feature a lot of girls, and one is a main character, and I have had comments before that she looks fat, and I'm actually totally okay with that. I think she just looks healthy. She looks like a normal girl who is built kind of like I am, a little bit on the heavier side. Like, even if I were to diet my butt off and exercise every day, all day, I seriously doubt that I would, like, I know I would never be like the little twiggy girls that can wear a size 1. I think that the smallest I would ever be would be like a size 12. Like, there's no way I would get any smaller than that, and I would be like unhealthy skinny at that point. So there are just some women who are built in a thick fashion, and they are strong, physically often strong. I actually remember hearing about a story about the U.S.'s prime candidate and probably one of the best chances for gold medals in the women's weightlifting, that she is struggling really, really hard because nobody will sponsor her because she doesn't have
an
ideal
body. She had a Kickstarter.
Did she have a Kickstarter? Okay,
she had a Kickstarter and got like 6 times what she asked for.
Well, I'm just saying that she was having trouble getting sponsorships because she didn't fit the physical ideal, because she is incredibly strong and has a really thick body type. Mm-hmm. So it's not like she's fat. She's full of muscles. But she's very thick looking because of the fact that her torso and her muscles in her torso and core area are all incredibly strong.
Well, yeah.
So what's the objection to her? I didn't understand.
She didn't look good enough for advertising, basically, like to be on TV. She looked too fat.
She wasn't like Sports Illustrated models.
No, she didn't look like
it would like break if they did what she did.
Oh god, yeah.
They would snap in half like the twigs they are.
Yeah, and who, by the way, don't actually look like that in real life, but that's camera angles and makeup and Photoshop.
And Photoshop, yeah. Like, but even then, it's like, even if you look at, like, say, the gymnasts are fairly thin and lithe, right? They're fairly...
They have to be.
But for her sport, it's a thick thing. Like, you have to be rippled with muscles and strong muscles at that, and especially through your core, to be able to lift all that stuff. And, like, she looks like a normal person when you look at her, but, I mean, she's definitely on the thick side. But, you know, you see her in her weightlifting gear, and you can tell this woman is muscled just all to hell. Like, she is incredibly thick, but she doesn't look like your typical female that, you know, the hot big boobs and the big hips and stuff like that. She's very, very core heavy. Like, and it's like a lot when you look at like the men's like the supermen competitions. Like, a lot of those guys look downright fat if you look at them.
Oh, they do.
Because they're so muscled through the core, instead of starving themselves to get that six pack. You know, look of a bodybuilder, they're actually totally ripped through their core, so they look really fat, but they're not. They're, like, just full of muscle everywhere. So it's kind of like one of those things where it's like there's actually, like, a fundamental disconnect between the activity and the anatomy.
Well, it's kind of hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Like, with bodybuilders, when they're at the shows and, like, you see them all, like, their muscles are so defined and they're, like, so... They're slick with oil. At that point, bodybuilders are at their weakest because they've been not drinking to make sure that their skin sticks to their muscles. They've been taking sponge pills to take the water out of their system, again, to make their muscles more defined.
You just said exactly what I was going to say. That's
see, I had a bodybuilder for a stepdad. I know exactly what he did.
And these guys, I mean, actually, there could be body image issues for men even on this, because if you study bodybuilding versus weightlifting, they're completely different. Those weightlifter guys don't look like that. And when you're looking at a rippled up muscled superhero dude or whatever with all these chunky muscles, looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger or whatever, those guys are astoundingly weak, and they are at their weakest there. But even when their muscles are big and cut and super defined, there are guys with muscles half that size who are stronger than them.
because they've done unnatural things to make the muscle tissue essentially swell. So they look strong, but they're not. If you actually wanted to know what a really strong guy looks like, he doesn't look like either the guys in the movies or the way they draw them in comic books. It's ludicrous, yes. And bodybuilders are extraordinarily weak. They've been known to faint on stage.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're so weak.
Yeah. Because they have to be
or have to go to the hospital.
Nice. Yeah. Insane how people think that, oh, man, that guy's so ripped. He must be the strongest person there. No, actually, that fat chick that he's with is probably, like, twice as strong as he is.
Yeah, Marie, those dudes that you're drooling over, they may not even be as strong as they look.
Well, actually, I think these particular guys are, and they're not really bodybuilders, they're just extraordinarily fit individuals.
Right.
Because they're in there running and stuff. Like, I don't know where, I think they're actually from Africa, and they're just built that way. Like, they don't look unnatural, they're not, like, really super, like, they don't have the really big, ultra-huge chests and stuff. They're more like Bruce Lee fit. You know,
oh, cool.
They got very broad shoulders, like they've just got this kind of really thick body type, but they've got this just really gorgeous definition going on, just because I think if they have the dark skin and they're sweating, but they look amazing. Like when 300 is a good example, because they actually used more weightlifting type techniques, and they're very thick through the torsos. If you look at the actors who trained for 300, but they're more like that, where they're very thick, but they've got a lot of definition going on in their chest and their muscles and stuff. Where it's obvious that they're incredibly fit, and they obviously are athletes, and they're just looking awesome. They look healthy. They don't look unhealthy. They don't look like bodybuilders. They look like extraordinarily fit athletes.
Well, this is why Batman is my favorite superhero, because he is a thick man. He has the muscles in the core. He doesn't have that itty-bitty waist. I mean, he's got the muscle definition, but he's got the muscles, too.
Here's my prediction for you, if you want it. DC and Marvel, with their superheroes, will never change. Whether you like that criticism that woman gave, that horror artist was given or not, they're not gonna. I've been watching for too long. They're not gonna. They think this is what 15-year-old boys want. We're marketing to 15-year-old boys. This is what they want. This is what we're giving them. Prove us wrong. It's gonna fall to people like you on the web to change any minds on that.
Well, I think it's starting to go. I think that there are actually, especially with now the access, like the less frowning upon on things like self-publishing and stuff, and more people entering and offering a larger variety of material, including superhero material that is not based on those particular perceptions, and that is more realistic or more gritty, or, you know, more going back to like the detective type comics and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot more of that going on, and there's a lot more richness and styles, and it's a lot easier now to actually connect with an audience that can support your work. I mean, yeah, we're not going to be a big giant company, but I think there's a lot more going on now for people who are looking for alternatives than there was, say, 10 years ago.
I agree. And I'm hoping to see it, because I've been a fan of alternate comics for many, many years. I've done nothing against superheroes. I gave up on superheroes 20 years ago, for the most part, like the movies. But I was always into independent stuff like Love and Rockets and Strangers in Paradise. Hell, I don't even know if people know what those are anymore.
I know Strangers in Paradise.
It's a great little, I mean, I don't know, it's a girl title. What the hell ever. I don't care.
I know a lot of guys who dug Strangers in Paradise. I know a lot of people who did dig that. But, you know, there are a lot of other comics that are popping up now that are definitely offering something different. For the superhero genre in specific, like they're offering definitely different looks.
And have you looked at some of the stuff G. Willow Wilson has done?
I haven't personally seen that lately.
Oh, G. Willow Wilson. She's an American comic book author. She's done some stuff for DC, including some superheroish and some mythology based. Actually, look for her work. She's very cool, by the way. Shout out to her if she's listening. She might be. But anyway, her stuff doesn't go in. Her stuff is more that classic style and not that exaggerated style.
Yeah. Well, and I think as more and more, and there are more and more women who are starting to do things like webcomics and getting into the genres that they like. And there are a lot of women out there who do like the superhero genre and definitely want to contribute to it. And, you know, I think as more and more are, you know, basically forced to express themselves in a more independent way, we're going to see more and more stuff showing up, essentially showing everybody what, you know, the variety that women do like.
Mm-hmm. And men.
And men. Yeah, and men.
I'm out here. I like other things, too.
Yeah. It's not just the 14-year-old boy. Especially, like, I've noticed when a lot of the time when, guys I know, their tastes have changed over the years. They do get into different stuff. So there is definitely a market beyond 14 years old and that is maturing, and there's definitely stuff that they are going to want other than that. So I think there's definitely room to grow, and which is a good news for us who are individual comic creators. But I think with that, we should probably end out. I want to thank our guests for coming on such short notice, and we will see you guys in the funny papers.